Welcome to The Wrap-Up, a weekly podcast that gives you an insider's look at the top stories in Hollywood. I'm your host, Sherrod Waxman, founder and editor-in-chief of The Wrap. Joining me is my co-host, Daniel Goldblatt, our assistant managing editor. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, Sharon. I will say a quick happy birthday, and then I will not mention it again for the rest of the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. Accepted, and thank you for blessedly we move along now. The pandemic's been hard on everyone in Hollywood, but perhaps no group was hit harder than actors who are still waiting for their big break. Because, as we know, not only did production shut down, but a lot of what pays the rent for young actors, waiting tables, walking dogs, disappeared too. So we will talk with four actors who we interviewed a year ago to see how they were doing, to check in on how they've survived this past year.
Then you may not understand what an NFT is. I feel like I'm almost there. I've almost got it. But Hollywood is jumping into the non-fungible token market with both feet. So how can Tinseltown profit off the boom? We'll discuss with Edward Moya, senior market analyst at Owanda, and Martin Nolan, executive director and chief financial officer of Julian's Auctions. But first, let's get into some headlines. The old adage is, of course, if at first you don't succeed, file again. As Endeavor filed a new registration statement with the SEC on Wednesday, marking their second attempt to go public. In 2019, Ari Emanuel and company were all set to go public on the New York Stock Exchange before pulling the IPO the day before it was set to happen. Obviously, a lot has happened since then, and the last 2 years have not exactly been a high point for the company, but maybe they consider $1.2 billion in losses in 2019 and 2020 good. I don't know, maybe. One thing that is different this time around is Elon Musk will join the board of directors, and usually when Elon Musk is involved in a business, that's usually a good thing. Sharon, do you think this IPO will be any more successful than it would have been for Endeavor 2 years ago?
Hard to say. I think it's a pretty bold move by Ari Emanuel, I have to say. You were asking, you know, bringing up some very commonsensical points. Losing $1.2 billion over the past 2 years, is that the kind of data point you want to walk into some investor's office with?
Yeah, no forward momentum at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, we wrote a lot of stories last year that said that Endeavor might go bankrupt. And the reason for that was because all of live entertainment was shut down. UFC, which drives a ton of their revenue, which they acquired, was on hiatus or was just on hold for the early part of the pandemic. And then, of course, production being shut down, there was no fees coming in for representation. Since that time, production has started again a little bit, but the main problem for Endeavor, which managed to survive not going, you know, survived the prospect of bankruptcy, they took on more debt. They took on more debt, and that they are now still really struggling under this crazy debt load that they have, which is why that's the main reason why they're losing all this money, $600 million a year, more or less, for 2019 and 2020. So I'm noting that they lost a lot of money in 2019, which was pre-pandemic as well. So this is a very interesting sales job. Bringing Elon Musk onto the board, sure, he's definitely sexy. It's definitely a sign of confidence when you have one of the richest men in the world, number one or number two, depending on the day, and one of the most, I'd say, exciting innovators and entrepreneurs of our time joining your board. That's a good thing. I don't know what he has to do with either agency representation or UFC or live entertainment. Those are definitely not his areas of interest, particularly the guy who has Tesla and SpaceX. At the same time, this is going to be a growth time for content. And that is a good thing. There is going to be a renewed interest in live entertainment. There is going to be a renewed interest in all manner of entertainment, live streaming, everything. And they have their hands, you know, very deep and dirty in that area. I think it's a bold move, especially to do it now, but I presume it's because he needs to do it because he's facing this debt burden. And it'll be really interesting to see if he pulls it off.
Yeah. Endeavor also sort of lost a little bit of their business with production because they had to sort of divest that part of their portfolio after the fight with
the
writers.
They lost their packaging fees, yes.
They lost packaging fees, but also like the writers and Hollywood sort of pushed back on the idea of them, you know, getting into production as well, because it seemed a little double dipping.
Well, agencies are not allowed to do production, which is why a lot of agents who want to be in it leave to become managers so that they can be producers, but they are not permitted to actually be producers. But the packaging fees was kind of an end run around that, where they would put projects together and in addition to the representation fees, take the packaging fee. It'd be interesting to find out how much of their business that was. I was talking to one of our pro writers, Tim Basinger, who wrote a really good analysis that's on the site this morning with Diane Haithman about what it means. Can this second IPO be successful? And he pointed out that the filing noted that they dropped $700 million last year in representation fees, which will also include their packaging fees. So some of that is not coming back. Very, very interesting to read the numbers that were laid out. We learned a lot of things. And as we've talked about previously, you know, the talent agencies are notoriously secretive. So going public is culturally like a big, big, big problem. We were trying to get them, as you'll recall last week, to talk about how they've improved their representation of women. By the way, along with Elon Musk, there's an African-American woman who is also meant to join the board, Fawn Weaver, but she is not somebody who's well known in entertainment. She's written about a bestseller about holding your marriage together. So I don't know. That's her area. It'll be interesting. Okay. So next topic, Georgia. Georgia is again in the political spotlight after Republicans who control much of the state political organizations passed sweeping changes literally overnight to the state's election laws, making it even more difficult to vote there. This has been talked about widely. You all have probably heard about the fact that you can't offer food and water to somebody who's in line waiting to vote. Georgia is a very popular place for Hollywood productions. It's the second most popular place, in fact, after California. And some, including the director of Ford versus Ferrari, James Mangold, have called for a boycott of production there in response to this restrictive new law. But Tyler Perry, who has a massive studio of his own in Atlanta, has spoken out against what he's calling, quote, the unconstitutional voter suppression law, but cautioned against a boycott. Daniel, what is the right thing to do here?
I think what I've seen in the last few days is that most people have taken the we're just going to wait for Stacey Abrams to tell us what to do approach, which I think is smart in Georgia, because pulling productions in Georgia would hurt the types of people that these voting laws hurt. They're not going to affect, you know, your Republicans, your red state type people. They're going to affect your more working class people. So it doesn't, if by doing this, you're actually not going to be hitting the right people that you want to. So it seems like to me, you're just going to see renewed focus in supporting new candidates. There's a governorship, I think, up for election soon there.
That's right.
So I think that's where you're going to see the focus, which makes sense to me. I mean, your initial reaction to be like, okay, we're just not good. Because that's what they did for when Georgia passed abortion laws, anti-abortion laws last year. And you saw a lot of that. Right. And it made sense then. This doesn't quite make as much sense. So hopefully it does seem like for the most part, you had some people like Mangold who were calling for that, but it seems like most people are like, wait a second, let's take a deep breath. Let's step back.
I actually want to like, so I got into this a little bit. James Mangold, just to be a little bit more precise, did not call for a boycott. He said he personally would not shoot there anymore. And it's that set off a conversation about whether a boycott should be called for. So to your point, Stacey Abrams did weigh in with a video last night in which she emphatically asked for people not to boycott. And when we're talking about not just Hollywood, then you're talking about big companies like Coca-Cola is based there, Delta's based there.
Delta, yeah.
And those companies have pushed back and said this is basically a trash law. President Biden has pushed back and said it's Jim Crow 2. So anyway, that question is basically been answered now by Stacey Abrams as of the last 24 hours. And it sounds like the boycott's gone away. But, you know, in general, this is going to be a pitched battle. And we all are aware that this apparatus for winning elections in the Republican parties is apparently the new stratagem that's going to roll out across other states too. So we're kind of in, and it's a really offensive strategy to be honest. And I'm neither a Democrat nor a Republican, but the idea of making it harder to vote in any way, shape or form seems to me like a bad way to go. But when your core demographic is going down by the day, I guess you're desperate and you'll do desperate things. That's what it feels like. Anyway,
yeah, it's always stunning that it's one side that tries to make voting harder and not the other.
Well, if the numbers were reversed, the Democrats would be trying to make voting harder, but the numbers demographically and over time plays in their favor. So
yeah, the more people that vote, the more it benefits them. Yeah. All right, Sharon, this is a weird one for me. It's not often I find myself agreeing with something Tucker Carlson has said, but it happened this week. After the Fox News host interviewed Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz, who was either embroiled in a sex trafficking controversy or the victim of an extortion plot. I don't know which it is. During his interview with Carlson, Gaetz defended himself against the accusations, painted himself and his father as the victim of a $25 million shakedown. But my favorite part was after the segment was over, Tucker came back out and called it, quote, one of the weirdest interviews I've ever conducted, and added, quote, I don't think that clarified much. It was part of a very bizarre week for Gaetz, who was trying to plot his move out of Congress and into the media. Sharon, I know you and I talked about this interview a lot on earlier this week. What did you make of all of it?
Yeah, the Tucker interview was hilarious. well, because Matt Gaetz was like trying to drag him into this problem, saying, hey, Tucker, remember that time you went to dinner with you, me, your wife, and this woman I was dating, unnamed and age undisclosed? You remember? And Tucker's like, no, I don't remember at all. I have no idea what you're talking about, in fact. So the idea that this was like the weirdest interview was like, clearly Matt Gaetz was trying to drag Tucker Carlson into this somehow, and at the same time totally muddy the waters by saying that in fact there's this extortion plot against me. So it really took me going back and reading a very clarifying Washington Post article, which made clear that in fact the Department of Justice is investigating Matt Gaetz completely independently of any extortion plot, whether that's a real thing or not, for alleged sex trafficking, because he was, I guess, dating the 17-year-old girl, so therefore a minor, and I guess mailing things over state lines or going with her over state lines.
I think.
So I couldn't wish it on a nicer guy. I mean, broke the law, but he's also just a complete, you know, he's the guy who went to Wyoming to try to get Wyoming voters not to vote for Liz Cheney after she voted to impeach our seditionist president. So, you know, couldn't happen to a nicer guy. Tucker. And the other thing I have to point out really fast, I know you're going to say something, is Rachel Maddow did a great, thank you very much, Rachel, exegesis on the guy who, where this started for Matt Gaetz, which was a DOJ investigation into some other operative, tax collector in Florida. Thank you so much. The state that keeps on giving great, unbelievable stories. This guy, Joel Greenberg, who has just had like one felony investigation after another. He's got like 33 felony charges pending against him for doing things like handing out $2 million in state contracts to six members of his wedding party immediately after being elected. So that part of it is like even more unbelievable, and you've got to be shitting me. Did a public official actually do this? Yeah. Apparently they did. Anyway, that's it.
Anything's possible in Florida. And then Gaetz went out and he's been talking about how talking to all these different companies about a job, Fox News and OAN. And then Fox News came out and said, no one has talked to him. We have no interest
in
him.
That was hilarious.
It's just such a weird week.
He's not having a weird week. He's become toxic and radioactive, Daniel. That's what happened.
I know. But it just seems like and then at one point in the interview, he tried to bring up an old story where Tucker Carlson was accused.
Oh, that was the other part. That was so good.
Tucker,
and then you would have liked to have a sex accusation against you. Tucker's like, what?
Yeah, like, and the other last thing, and that I didn't even get to when Tucker at the very end of his show was like, tomorrow, the entire hour with Matt Gaetz. Like, he made this joke, and it was actually pretty funny. It's the one time I've actually laughed at or with Tucker Carlson.
With not Tucker at him. Carlson. There you go.
Yeah. All right. As always, we like to conclude this first segment with a little something we call Wax On, Wax Off, where we allow our founder and editor-in-chief, Sharon Waxman, the opportunity to speak out about something she's particularly into this week, her wax on, and something maybe that has her a little more riled up, her wax off. Sharon, as always, the floor is yours.
Thank you. This week, my wax on, wax off is about the George Floyd trial that's going on in Minnesota this week. This is a trial that will go down in history as one of the most important and historic moments of our time. And we are fortunate and also, I would say, cursed to be able to watch this, because not all trials, of course, are televised. This is being made available to the public. It has been, I've been watching it and trying not to watch it. It's like watching it through, you know, half shut eyes, it's like watching a horror movie. On the plus side, I'm going to say that it is a very important teaching moment for us as a society, a painful moment, but an important teaching moment. What we've seen in this trial is in great detail, again and again, we're watching the murder in real time of a human being. And it is excruciating. And we're seeing other bits and pieces of video that we haven't seen before. And we're hearing the testimony of the people who bore witness to this as this was happening. And I will say, in the plus column, you're hearing of the morality of the people who stood by, whether it's this young MME fighter who was calling out to Chauvin as he's choking the life out of this poor man who's already been arrested and is in handcuffs and on the ground and a threat to no one. The morality of other people like the off-duty EMT, I think it is, a firefighter who was trained in emergency medicine, pleading to be permitted to come in and offer medical aid to this man who's clearly in need of it. Or the teenager who took and her younger sibling, 9-year-old, who stood there and she had the courage to film this thing. So all of these things, I think we have to salute the bravery and the morality of those people for what they did in that moment and for coming forward to bear witness. It's very, very important that we all see this. And then the dark side of this, right? To me, you know, I've seen the tape. It's hard to watch it again. I've watched it in pieces. I really can't watch it anymore, even though I feel like it's a responsibility to do so. But there also the body cam that was on Derek Chauvin as they approach George Floyd in his car. What stays with me is the fear and panic on George Floyd's face as he's sitting in his car holding his steering wheel. And there's two officers coming up and tapping on the window. And one of them has drawn a gun. Oh, he's no threat, right? The guy like gave a counterfeit $20 bill in the Stop and Shop, whatever it's called, the cup, whatever. And you see on his face the fear that you must think every Black man in America is legitimately feeling when a cop taps on the window and he says, "Don't kill me." Because he knows that that's a possibility. To see that, you know, I've seen it in movies. To see it in real life is so chilling, is so shameful. It makes me ashamed to be American. It makes me feel all the more intensely for understanding what I can never experience and never know as a white person. And so that's what I want to say about this George Floyd trial. It is an important moment for our country, and I beg and pray that we learn from it and grow from it and don't have to have this happen anymore. That's it.
I couldn't agree more. Let's hope it ends the way we all hope it does. All right, that'll do it for this week's Wax On, Wax Off. Coming up, we'll talk to a group of actors about how they managed to get through the pandemic and a look at how Hollywood is trying to get into the NFT game. Stay tuned. At the start of the pandemic, The Wrap talked to a group of up-and-coming actors to see how they were weathering the storm. It's been a year, almost to the day, since we published that story, and this week we're publishing an update to that story, and we've invited several of these actors to the podcast to talk about how they stayed afloat during the pandemic. Four of them join us now. Please welcome to The Wrap-Up, Romy Smith, Natalie Linez, Harley Harrison Yanoff, and Lee Dowd. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
So you're the folks who really were hit hard when the entertainment industry basically shut down a year ago, a little bit more than a year ago. Romy, let me start with you. You were auditioning for Broadway, right, when the virus hit. And of course, Broadway shut down completely. Yeah. Tell us how you lived through it and what's happened to your acting career such as it is and how you're doing and how you're managing.
It was definitely, I think for the first time, a working adult, to have that break, was a blessing in disguise. I guess it was not under the best of circumstances, but it allowed me to connect and get closer to family, get closer to friends. There were also family members that were really affected personally. They were in the hospital and had to undergo life-threatening operations, but they did make it through, thankfully.
And yeah, glad to hear it.
I've grown much, much closer to my family since then. Career-wise, it was definitely an adjustment to not be able to go to auditions, working on sets, even, you know, New York City being a ghost town was definitely an adjustment. But as with anything that's dark, I would say, you know, there's light at the end of the tunnel. So since that time, you know, productions have resumed. Broadway has not yet reopened, but, you know, the mayor has indicated that it will be coming in the fall. But it also allowed me to tap into other creative resources and work with other actors on projects that they had, you know, been sitting on the back burner for so long. Also able to get into producing, which is been a passion project of mine as well.
How have you supported yourself? Not that Broadway is such a stable way to support yourself anyway. It's a high wire act at the best of times, but.
Yeah, you know, I think actors would definitely agree that we have worked some of the most odd jobs or taken on jobs that, we probably wouldn't have taken on under regular circumstances. I know I've worked in retail. I still work in retail. I've worked for Amazon delivering packages to people. So I could definitely say that I've worked so many different jobs to stay afloat during that time. Mm.
Natalie, you were about to go into production, I think, on a Starz project when this all happened. How did that end up turning out for you, and how did you then pivot during the pandemic?
Yeah, so I actually booked that show in February. Oh. I think, yeah, like 2 weeks before or 3 weeks before everything happened. So I was lucky enough to get here to New York, because I'm from LA, and shoot the pilot. And then I came back to LA to kind of like gather my things to then go back to New York. And it was like a no-go. So the adjustment there was just like, my mindset was so like, I'm going to New York for the next 5 months to like, whoa, that's not happening. And I'm a very optimistic person. So in the beginning, I was like, 3 weeks, because they were saying like 2 weeks or something. Yeah. So I was like, biggie, you know, just means I get to spend some more time at home before I go to the big city. But that obviously wasn't the case. So I was home, and then we were lucky enough to go back into production in November. But for those months at home, I think, like Romy was saying, just a lot of like, there was some time spent with family. Mine's in Orange County and I live in LA. So we weren't like, I wasn't driving much down there. You know what I mean? I was hunkering down. But when I could, I saw some family, but mostly just a lot of self-discovery, I feel like, during those times, like a lot, because obviously it forced us to stick with ourselves and not, you know, I think something I used to do so often, because I don't have a normal job, it is just acting, is like go to a coffee shop and distract myself by like being there around a bunch of people at least and like working on my laptop. But for this, we had to just stay home. So yeah. And I actually developed my now business during those 5 months.
Which is what?
I created a journal. So it's a morning routine. I actually developed it because of the structure that I needed during the pandemic. It's called MAGIC, and MAGIC is an acronym that stands for meditation, affirmations, gratitude, intentions, and coffee. So it's just,
hey, I love that last essentials. One. I'm yeah, in on that last one.
Right? Yeah, right.
So just a morning routine that sets you up for a successful and mindful day. Yeah. So that was a big blessing in disguise. I got to really discover that and develop it, really.
But you said that's become a business?
Yeah. So I launched in February and I've sold over 200 journals, and people are absolutely loving it. It's a physical. Oh, look, I have it right here.
It's an actual journal.
Yeah.
It's like an actual journal. Yeah.
Yeah. It's an actual journal. And this is the template every single day that I do every morning and that I, you know, tell people about, because it's seriously changed my life since the pandemic, just having something to wake up to and look forward to and setting those intentions, whether even if it can't happen, you know, in that time because nothing was going on, but like, these are my goals for when all of this does end, and it just keeps the hope, you know?
But has that changed your desire to be an actor? Do you want to maybe pivot and become an entrepreneur or something? You've already started a business, so.
Yeah, I would definitely, I guess, identify as both right now, because I'm doing both. And as us actors know, there's so much downtime, like so much. I am in New York because of this show, and I was supposed to be flying back and forth because I'm recurring. So right. I'm in every episode, but I'm not working 5 days a week.
Yeah.
So besides auditions, I'm, you know, filming auditions and then just working on this every day.
And the name of the show, have you told us the name of the show?
It's a spinoff of Power.
Oh, cool.
It's called Raising Kanan. So that's coming out in like July, I think.
All right. Very cool. Very cool. That's really interesting. Harley, tell us what you were doing when the pandemic hit. And I guess you've also developed your own initiative in the meantime. So tell us what you're doing then, and then tell us what you've done in the interim.
Sure. Yeah. So basically, you know, I'm in New York City. And so, you know, before the pandemic, you know, same thing as all the actors, sort of, you know, just going to the next thing, auditioning, you know.
Are you like a TV actor, or are you a stage?
Yeah, TV, film, but I do sing, so I do stage work as well. You know, I'm also a serial entrepreneur, so I have a few businesses, and you know, one of my large businesses was a catering and staffing company in New York City and Los Angeles, where, you know, I employ hundreds of actors for, you know, temporary
gigs. That is a brilliant idea.
Yeah, so basically the concept is it's actors need flexible income, artists and students and that. And so basically created a business around that where, you know, we work with hotels and catering companies and restaurants and PR firms and things like that, where we'll employ people for temporary gigs. And it's sort of like work when you want to work. We developed like an on-demand payment structure so that people are getting paid the next day. And the business really flourished over the years. And so it's been a great thing for me because I've been able to, you know, focus on my art and work while, you know, running this business. In addition to that, I have a summer theater workshop for kids. And so those were all going on simultaneously. Yeah, I think early March events started stopping. You know, we typically will do over 100 events a month, and all of a sudden everything was getting canceled. All the weddings were canceled, and I was left with sort of a big question mark of what is going to happen. And I think similar to, I forget who said it, but, you know, I think it was Natalie, you know, we're like, oh, okay, it'll be a few weeks and then things would pick up. And very quickly sort of learned that it wasn't the case. And then Broadway shut down. So at that point, I realized I needed to figure something out. So I kind of spent 2 days just in a panic. And then sort of got myself together and, you know, thought about, okay, well, is there something I can do, you know, virtually? And this is before, you know, everybody and their mother knew the term Zoom. But I figured I'd send an email out to like the kids' parents who go to my summer theater camp and ask them if they wanted sort of a one-time virtual acting class, you know, and I figured that would at least like just make me feel like there was something and then I would figure it out. And, what ended up happening was, you know, five people turned into 30 people overnight. And, I contacted a couple of Broadway friends in New York with me. And I said, hey, I think there might be something here. Do you want to help like teach a couple of these classes? And it very quickly in the span of a week, started just getting a lot of press, and we ended up being this global company called Broadway From Home. And what we have been doing still to this day is these live performances and productions and workshops. And we connect kids with different Broadway actors and TV film actors for classes and performances and things like that. And it's been an amazing sort of thing to see kids from literally all over the world. We're talking, you know, China, Australia, Los Angeles, New York, Finland. They're coming together in, you know, similar sort of things like this with, you know, nine boxes on a screen and making art. So that's been this huge sort of savior for my brain, along with, you know, just being able to employ a lot of other artists out there. You know, because
that's
I took a lot of pride in just, you know, providing temporary work solutions for people.
But is it really temporary? I mean, are you going to, is this now what you're going to do, or do you think?
So, so the Broadway From Home, basically we're going to pivot into sort of a hybrid model. You know, we're going to start sort of having, you know, maybe rehearsals online and then bring them into the city for, you know, a live show and master classes, and then start connecting, you know, Broadway performers and film TV actors with in-person masterclass opportunities. So, you know, we're pretty flexible with our pivoting, and, you know, we're kind of feeling out as things are opening up, what that looks like. But, to this day, you know, we've employed over 100 actors, and, you know, provided them really with, you know, a nice source of income as well as, something to do during the pandemic, because I think, you know, echoes to everybody here is that a huge sort of thing in the past year is, how do you stay busy and how do you feel like something you're doing actually, you know, has purpose and meaning, and it's kind of, you know, checked all those boxes. So, it's obviously been a really weird year. It's been a really difficult year, you know, just in terms of mental health and things like that. But, you know, as Romy said, there's definitely some positives that came out of it. And, yeah.
Are you still auditioning now?
Yeah. I mean, things are now starting to come back. So I was fortunate enough to, I just did some voiceover work for a new, film that's going to come out. It's called The Hub. So I was able to do that from my, you know, apartment/studio. And then, you know, as things are sort of opening up, as Romy said, you know, the stage element of things are a little off, but you know, the entrepreneur in me is sort of thinking, okay, well, what types of outdoor things can we do? And, you know, what can we produce, you know, with that sort of hybrid model? So, yeah, I think as things come back, I'll certainly get back out there and do that. But, you know, I definitely want to try to stay ahead of the curve and try to continue to create, you know, art and work opportunities for myself as well as other performers.
Okay. Lee, you were shooting a Netflix series, I think, when the pandemic started, and your sort of side business in event management kind of had to go virtual. How did you find yourself adjusting to everything as the pandemic started to unfold?
I was lucky enough to stay employed, even though all my events were moving virtual. It was an interesting time. So I had wrapped production on a Netflix show that I don't think I was allowed to announce when we did the first interview, but they just announced a release date now, almost a year and a half later. I'm in part two of Lucifer's season 5 on Netflix.
Oh yeah, that's right. That was this week.
Yeah, they just made that announcement. So I think I'm allowed to say it. So
for sure.
For the event side, you know, I work with a lot of charity partners. I do a lot in the nonprofit space. And where I really found my niche in virtual events was the fact that I've also produced short film and narrative feature length film. And I think the pivot I was able to take with my clients was creating really engaging content for virtual events that allowed nonprofits to continue to tell their stories and fundraise. Because out of all my clients, nonprofits were the ones who had to continue trucking along and raising money. So it started really with a 9-episode concert series that we did with Facebook. It was called Out Loud Raising Voices. It was meant to raise the voices of LGBTQ plus identifying musicians, folks who were really relying on Pride festivals to perform. So when all Pride festivals got canceled, we gave these artists a space to perform, and we created this 9-episode series. Each episode headlined, anchored with a strong allied or LGBTQ artist, celebrity hosts and appearances and things like that. And then it pivoted into some other hour-long TV specials. I just wrapped production on another TV special for a nonprofit out of Palm Springs. So it'll be airing on NBC. It's been awesome to still tell story and also know that in a small way, there's some social good behind it as well.
Really, so great. I'm wondering, for all of you, I have a question. You know, you're this acting job, there's no way you can ever really make that pandemic proof. You know, Sharon and I in journalism, we just started working from home and slacking, and we went about our day just the same. It didn't really affect us, and I've always felt very lucky for that. Do you find yourself thinking now that any sort of side projects you have, secondary things, you want to make sure that those are pandemic proof, because you don't want to be caught, you know, sort of with all your eggs in one basket, I guess, so to speak? Like, I'm just wondering if you've been sort of planning, you know, we're almost out of this one, but it just feels like maybe there'll be another one, or maybe we won't, I don't know. But are you thinking about that going forward to make sure that, you know, you're not in the same situation again? Harley, you're nodding. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, to be perfectly honest with you, I think even before the pandemic, my mindset from graduating college was, you know, always, yes, what I want to do is act. And that is obviously and always will be the number one thing that I want to do, is I want to perform. But there, you know, even like I said, before the pandemic, it's one of those things where you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket, because you don't know what's going to happen. And whether it's a pandemic or it's just, you know, a bad 6 months of auditions, I think that it's important to have those other sort of interests. And, you know, and if you can find a way to make money doing other things as well, I think it's really important. And I think that what the pandemic has done for a lot of actors is sort of made them sort of take a look in the mirror and be like, okay, like, I think that, you know, obviously I don't want to change what I've been doing, but it would be really nice to, you know, not panic and have, you know, everything that I've been working for completely inaccessible. So I think that for me, you know, it again, I sort of did that beforehand, but I think that given what we've seen in the last year, it's really important to, and it seems like everybody in here has sort of already been doing that, which I think is great. But yeah, I think that'll echo just beyond, because I think that very few actors, you know, were employed acting, you know, throughout the pandemic. So yeah, absolutely.
I think it's always great to always, as an actor, have hobbies and things that you do, because it's so important to be well-rounded, you know what I mean? And to have other passions, because something I've learned from the couple things that I have done, it's always been out of state, and I've just had so much time off. Like, I don't know about y'all, but whenever I'm on location, I am like in my hotel room for so much of the time, and I realize it's just so important to have passion projects regardless.
But all of you are committed to continuing to act.
Absolutely.
Continuing to pursue that.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think the thing about the entertainment industry is it's not going anywhere. Like, I have hope that, you know, I'm always going to be able to pursue that. But also fully aware, because of all the self-work that I have done during this time too, is like, if I don't want to do it, it's okay. And to not let my ego get in the way of that, and to be like, this isn't something I want to do anymore. But as of right now, absolutely. Especially just being on that, like, I think I'm like 6 years into pursuing this. So it's like 10 years when you like make it.
All right, guys, I can't thank you enough for being here and sharing your stories with us. You can check out, we wrote an entire article, like I said, catching up with these four people and a number of other actors. You can check that out on The Wrap beginning tomorrow. I think we're launching that series. Romy, Lee, Harley, Natalie, thank you so much for sharing your stories with us and
thank
joining
you
us
guys.
On The Wrap Up.
Good luck. Stay
thanks
in touch.
For having me.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for having me.
Take care. NFTs, or non-fungible tokens, are the latest digital craze. The most common NFTs are tied to things like art, pictures, video highlights, which is the NBA is already getting into big time. But now Hollywood is starting to see if it can get involved and presumably make some money from these digital collectibles. Here to help us make sense of it all are Awanda senior analyst Ed Moya and Martin Nolan, executive director and chief financial officer of Julian's Auctions. Thanks for joining us, guys.
Welcome.
Pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Before we get too deep into things, I guess, Ed, I'll try it with you. Is it possible to explain NFTs to someone who doesn't understand them? Just maybe like give me like the 60 seconds Cliff Notes version of this.
Yeah, more than happy to. So right now what we're seeing is the non-fungible tokens. It's really changing the world of art. I think right now you're seeing there's a new way of buying scarce assets, and right now it's in the form of memes, it's in the form of short videos, and it's all on your computer. And I think what's fascinating for many people is that you can just buy the rights to a certain image, and that is done on the blockchain technology. And for many people, this is not like buying a painting where you hang up on your wall. You're buying with cryptocurrencies, and you're purchasing the rights to a rare asset. And it's really taking over the cryptocurrency markets right now. It's completely where all the interest is, and it's pretty fascinating right now.
And how exactly are you seeing Hollywood get in on this trend?
Well, right now, I think it's still in the early stages, because right now, for the most part, this growth has just exploded over the past couple of months. And you're seeing, I think there has been this tremendous amount of interest that with CryptoPunks, memes, you're starting to see that there's like these rare pieces of art are going for millions of dollars. And I think what now a lot of Hollywood insiders, they're really excited as far as branching out into this new, you know, digital art world, and you're starting to see that the interest is widespread. It's covering musicians, it's covering athletes, and I think that you're probably going to have that. I think the marketplace is just in its infancy and it's still growing, and no one knows exactly how it's going to evolve. There's all these concerns that this is a bubble, but there's tremendous interest here. And I think what we're also seeing is that the public is really, I think, behind this. And I think that you're probably going to see that this is kind of changing the way a lot of people view art.
I have my own questions as to whether this is going to play out to become a true marketplace over time. But if it does, there's no doubt that Hollywood is between, I would say, entertainment and sports and celebrity, that sort of Venn diagram. It's going to be the place where there's an endless, essentially, you know, fount of potential NFTs that could be created. So, Martin Nolan, talk to us a little bit about how Julian's Auctions, which is known for auctioning prime memorabilia from, you know, big name either celebrities or, you know, and movie stars, how you're getting involved and how you see this shaping up as an actual marketplace.
Yeah, so, you know, at Julian's Auctions, we're selling things. We're selling tangible assets that have a story attached, like Marilyn Monroe's dress when she sang Happy Birthday, President Kennedy, or Kurt Cobain's guitar when he did the MTV Unplugged performance, sold for record amounts. And the gentleman mentioned that, you know, when you're selling the NFTs, we're selling, you're buying NFTs, that's, you're buying the rights. And I think that's the big concern with the celebrity world, is if they're selling something from them, that they're also giving up their rights. And I think that's where the issue will be, as regards when, like, a star will make a decision to get on board this NFT train, if you will, and, and what are they selling and what are they actually giving up? Because if they're giving up rights to something, that's the one area where the celebrity, the musician, the sports star, the Hollywood star, they want to control that. That's really important.
But wouldn't there be even more potential from the studios themselves that have the rights to, say, The Godfather, the original script? I'm making things up here, but the Star Wars endless number, I can't even start to reel off
the what franchise you
might
up,
what you might create.
Yeah, you think about, what are you selling and what are you buying? So from the studio's point of view, what are they selling? Because the movie is already out there. So then if you're buying an NFT of a clip from the movie or from a basketball game or artwork or whatever, the artwork is still out there, right? You can still go to see the Mona Lisa at the Louvre in Paris, regardless of if someone sold an NFT and they own the NFT. So you have the... You covered the fact that, oh, I own this. But what do you own? You own the token, that you have the chain of ownership. You're in the digital ledger, you know, Tezos or, you know, Ethereum, whatever it is, ledger to say, yeah, you're the owner. But then what, that and $2 get you on the bus downtown? I'm just learning about it. Believe me, I'm fascinated. We had a big auction at the weekend, sold 990 items, over 600 guitars. And I'm thinking, wow, if I was just selling digital tokens, wouldn't my life be so much easier? I wouldn't need to have four warehouses and tons of staff and photography and printing catalogs. I mean, it would be amazing. And, you know, I think about this and I go back to Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. And one of my colleagues still working with me, pounding the table in 2011, he was harvesting Bitcoins at $5 each. I thought he lost the plot. Still in the game to this day. Now he's pounding the table with me about NFTs, and I'm still on the bench as a guy. Am I getting involved in this? You know, my background is in finance. I was on Wall Street and worked for JP Morgan, Merrill Lynch, and we always followed, like, Warren Buffett. He said, buy the companies you know. If you drink Coca-Cola, buy Coca-Cola. If you have Microsoft on your computer or an Intel chip, buy Intel, buy Microsoft, buy the things you know. And sort of that's where I come from. But then in 1999, when Marty Zweig, a very famous investor on Wall Street, bought Marilyn Monroe's dress that she sang Happy Birthday to President Kennedy for $1.2 million at auction, I thought, oh my God, this is a guy that I subscribe to his stock picks. He's the hot stock guy that you want to buy what he's buying. And now he's buying a dress. So in 2005, I joined the auction world and I got to sell that same dress in 2016 for $4.81 million. Four times what he bought it for in 1999. Wow. He was good right. Move. So there's something here with NFTs, and I'm desperately trying to learn, and that's why I'm joining as many podcasts
conversations
to learn and to get other people's opinions as well.
Ed, what would you say to Martin, who is a NFT skeptic?
Well, I think there was an example recently, and I'm forgetting the specific art piece, but where the NFT went for more than the actual original artwork. And I think what you're seeing is that right now, art, you know, it's all about what people are willing to pay. And right now you're seeing that there is this new wave of trader or investor, and they're interested in NFTs. So I think, yeah, you're going to probably see the art world is going to continue to evolve. And there's so much reason why you're seeing artists really kind of scramble to get a part of this. I think that part of when you create your NFT, the artist can assign a certain percentage that they'll be able to, you know, recapture on every resale. I think that the art world is going to continue to kind of be skeptical about this, but the interest is growing. And I think that you're starting to see that there's definitely some pockets where, you know, there needs to be some changes. But right now, I think you're probably going to continue to see NFTs grow. It seems that the interest is there, and it's been nonstop over these last few months.
Let's pretend I understand what selling an NFT actually means. I feel like I'm mostly there with that part of it. If you buy one, what do you actually have, and how do you then profit from what you've purchased, other than, I guess, waiting to sell it again a few years later? Like, how do you profit off of these NFTs if you're a buyer?
Well, right now, you know, I think what you're, you know, hopeful for is that we've seen this massive appreciation, especially when you take a look at some of these other online sellers, websites, like the CryptoPunks. You've seen a tremendous doubling, tripling of these prices in just a matter of weeks. And I think what you're seeing is that you basically own the code to that specific art piece. And when you're ready, and if you want to sell it, you can then just put it up on one of those sites, and you'll probably see interest, and you'll be able to track the interest, because there are replicas, there are lots of similar artworks in a lot of these instances, and you'll be able to determine whether or not, you know, you like the current valuations that are going for that. So some people there, you know, a lot of times, you know, these some of these earlier pieces of work, you know, were given away for free, and now we're seeing them go for, you know, hundreds or if not millions of dollars. So you're probably going to see that a lot of people that are buying them right now in January, February, March, they're probably going to be holding on to these for quite some time. And right now, the interest is growing. Even some of the whether you're looking at NBA Top Shot, those prices are still kind of I think they're somewhat, you know, stable for the most part. But I think that as we see more celebrities embrace this, I think you're going to probably see much more interest as far as that part of the market too. Collectibles are growing. And then also too, we haven't really touched the metaverse. I think that's one of the big unknowns. And that's one of the more nerdier people are kind of focused on and saying that this is going to be the gateway to that. So I think you know, there's so many different ways.
Hold on.
Yeah.
What's the metaverse?
Well, it's the digital world. It's
interweb.
Yes. So basically you're going to see people are going to be thinking this is their way of living in the Matrix. And there's a lot of interest that, when you take a look at the, you know, there was over 120 million in sales in 2020. The metaverse was a good, you know, good chunk of that. Roughly, let's say a third, I believe. We don't know how NFTs are going to evolve, but right now I think that there's lots of different potential revenue streams, and it seems that the digital world, art world, is evolving, and I think that you're probably going to see that people are going to want to have some exposure to this, because it does seem like it is still in its infancy.
So it comes back to, I think, value. It's like, you know, what is something valued at? What something is valued at, what something is, what somebody is prepared to pay for something, that's a value. So Let's say a guitar sells at auction for $1 million. It's valued at $1 million. And I think the same applies with NFTs. It's supply and demand. And right now, the demand is much greater than supply. And that's why we saw the NFT sold a couple of weeks ago for $69 million. And then suddenly it becomes world news. Mm-hmm. We're all talking about it. And so we're all piling in. And yet the supply is not there. And we have been contacted by numerous, and I mean numerous, high-profile celebrities wondering how can they get in on the act of what is it about? We're educating them. And, of course, their big reservation is, what are they giving up? Like, obviously, they're selling something for huge money. What are they giving up? There has to be something they're losing. And that's what's keeping the supply so limited right now. And obviously, the supply-demand theory applies in NFTs just as it does with coal or orange juice or any other commodity.
So sounds like a bunch of high-priced lawyers need to dig in and kind of figure out who owns what. We've reported in the piece that
we did. That's all going to happen. And the lawyers will be ones making money again.
But we had a big piece about Hollywood and NFTs this week on our pro service. And one thing we reported there is that the talent agency UTA has created an NFT division already. Like they, I'm not quite sure, and I don't think they're quite sure what they're creating, but they've made a decision that it's a big enough thing that they need to devote senior resources to it and to figure it out for their clients and presumably for the studios that they work with as well.
And it might be partly to protect their clients from being exploited by other people selling NFTs that they don't have ownership of those rights that's included in that NFT by that celebrity. So that's, you know, one part of it as well.
Yeah.
Art, I'm wondering in your business, as you start to research this, do you think of NFTs as something that will be in addition to what you're doing, or do you see it eventually replacing what you've been doing?
If it becomes something real and we all get involved, and I'm still haven't drank the Kool-Aid, to be honest, I see our business will continue. People will still want to have the guitar because they can play it. They still want to have the dress. They still want to have that artwork on the wall. They want something tangible. Not everyone can relate to saying, I own this, but like I have nothing to show for it. And maybe in years to come, or weeks to come, or months to come, whatever the timeline is, it will appreciate in value. You don't know. At the end of the day, being a conservative investor myself, I like to think, well, I have the tangible assets. Even if it doesn't appreciate in value, I have something that I know I can touch, I can appreciate, I can talk about, and you know, tell stories about. Whereas if I have an NFT, I'm not sure what I actually have. In fact, I think it breaks down into two types of NFTs. And again, I'm just learning, but I saw where there's a type of NFT you own where you can own part of, let's say, a game, a race car game in Monte Carlo, where somebody bought 5% of that game with an NFT, 5% of the NFT of that game. And then the revenue stream will pay out 5% of the profits to the person that owns 5% of the NFT. So there's two different ownerships, I believe. And again, I'm not an expert and I'm just learning.
I am also not an expert. I am also still learning. I think you guys got me a little closer. A little closer. Martin, Ed, thank you so much for joining
us
here today.
We
really appreciate it. Thank you, guys. And thanks, Ed.
Thank you for having us.
And that's it for this week's episode of The Wrap-Up. Thank you to all of you, our listeners. And remember to please follow or subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcast. Be sure to rate and review us and let us know what you think of the pod.